On this week's show, the tools to achieve decarbonization and profitability with Brittany Harris from Qflow. In this week's news, how investments in technology are connecting distributors to contractors, and more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. Here we go. Time to rock and roll into the show. I got Nathan. I got Brittany. I got new show stuff for you. We got some crazy news. We're going to talk about some crazy things. But before we do, we got to pause for the calls.
Everyone supports a culture of well-being in the field and is equipped with the tools to help prevent suicide in construction. ProCourse Safety Qualified courses were built in partnership with our customers, elevating enhancements to their standard OSHA training. And the Bringing the Right Mindset series equips individuals and leaders alike with the skills necessary to really build resilient teams. We've made these three courses available for free and on demand, and they're offered both in English as well as Spanish, and they are CEU certifiable. ProCourse.com/certified-qualified is where we host our ProCourse Learning Portal, and anyone can use their ProCourse credentials or create a free account to get started.
All right, we're back. Brittany Harris, Nathan Wood, great to see you guys. You know, Nathan, when I saw this topic come up, I thought, if anybody knows anything about this, it's got to be you. I got to bring the big guns, Brittany, to talk to you. So it's great to have you this morning, Nathan.
Man, I am excited. Apologies if there's any noise. We're so close to being done with the house. We got some concrete pour in the side yard, but really excited to dive into this one.
Yeah, so am I. So Brittany, say hello to everybody. Give a little intro. You know, how'd you get here all the way across the pond, right? Are you traveling? Are you over here in the U.S.? I know you were bouncing back and forth. So where are you? And let's talk a little bit about you this morning.
Yeah. Well, hi, everyone. It's so great to be here. I'm back in the UK at the moment. I have been spending a huge amount of time in New York and Chicago, and I'm missing the Windy City, if I'm quite honest. It's a bit too warm here. Let's be frank. That was so British to instantly talk about the weather. That's terrible. But yeah, I mean, how we got here. So I'm a civil engineer. I've been in the industry for about 12 years, working primarily on the consulting side with the likes of Mott MacDonald and Bureau Happold Engineering. Bit of a stint on site in Hong Kong with Langer Ork, which was like no other project I've ever seen. 40 meter deep excavation into bright pink granite, overnight explosives because it's a 24 hour site. So during the day, digging holes, filling them with trinitrotoluene, blowing it up overnight and digging it back out. Absolute chaos. You wouldn't see it. We wouldn't see it over in the UK for sure. But an amazing experience in construction. And now founding and running Qflow to ultimately decarbonize this crazy industry.
Okay, so we got to go back because people listening are going to want to know. So excavating, how deep and putting in how did you, logistically, that's got to be a nightmare.
I mean, yeah, chaos. So this was the South Island Line connection of the MTR, so their underground rail network. So we were working on the Admiralty Station box, which is where the South Island Line was going to connect in. Hong Kong, as many people know, is largely granite underneath if you're not over the water. So we had this one massive station box hole, and I was leading the sort of breaking under what was about a 30-story building. So we had the pile caps on a transfer beam above our heads, and we were breaking underneath that, installing dowels to reinforce it as we continued the break. Then on the opposite side of the station box, where we were able to blast, we were digging holes, packing it with explosives, and then pouring it up overnight and then digging it all out again. So yeah, amazing, incredible.
All right, we're gonna pause for a second just because We get accused in this industry of being, you know, not innovative, you know, yes, we lacking technology, et cetera. That takes an absolute pinpoint accuracy. You're blowing things up. You've got other buildings being held up. You're removing it, putting pilings back in to reshore it up. And you've got people underneath there. Like, that just has to tell people we are innovative. We do know what we're doing in construction. And that's amazing.
It is amazing what this industry can achieve. And it's why I absolutely love the construction industry. It is so powerful in terms of pushing through what could be complete blockers to other people, and ultimately building the world around us. I mean, if anyone's been to Hong Kong and been on their underground system, it is one of the most clean and speedy and easy to navigate I've ever been on. Nothing against the New York Metro, but, you know, slightly different game there. I won't do the New York one town. But yeah, it's just such a great testament to say, you know, we're going to build a flipping big hole in the ground in granite, probably the hardest thing to break through. And yet you can do it. Just absolute perseverance and problem solving that you see in this industry.
That's awesome. Nathan?
So again, I love granite. I love blowing stuff up too. But I have to imagine some of those things at a certain point does have an impact on our environment, does it not?
Absolutely. I mean,
go on.
So sustainability, I don't think, was particularly high on the agenda there. Not to say that, you know, they didn't care, but it wasn't really a big talking point. It was more how quickly and how effectively can we build this station, in a really interesting way, because Langer Ork are obviously an international organization with some pretty strict internal requirements around safety. It was a fascinating site from that perspective, seeing the conflict of cultures and approaches to building and construction, where you've got a European general contractor leading the works and trying to instill these health and safety approaches to workers from all across the sort of South Asia bubble. And certainly saw some things that would make you very nervous. But I think Langer Ork did a brilliant job at really trying to manage that across the pond and ultimately delivered a phenomenal project.
So take us through that to Qflow, because you're certainly not the first industry person that's gone to go do software, right? what's your story? How'd that work out?
So I never planned to be a civil engineer, but fell in love with the problem solving side of our industry. And obviously went on to study it and ended up working on this crazy site in Asia, and really did fall in love with construction. It is an amazing industry that builds the world around us, that gives us access to water and roads and telecoms and all the things that make life easy and fun and exciting. But it has this sort of dark side. It's not the most efficient, I think we'll all agree, and it's certainly not the most sustainable. So as an industry, we consume about 40% of the world's raw resources. So we are the largest single consumer of raw resources in the world. And on top of that, we contribute about 40% of waste to landfill. So this linear approach to construction that we have, where we dig it out the ground, transform it into something like a steel beam, put in a building, use it for a few years, take it back down, and then stick it back in the ground, really doesn't work. It's not economically sensible or environmentally sensible, but ultimately it has this like horrible knock-on effect around the world. And if you've ever been to any of these mining sites or seen the impact on that very long tail of the supply chain, you'll really start to appreciate the impact that we have as an industry, not just on our cityscapes, but also the broader globe. So yeah, after a few years of being in the industry and still loving it, but seeing some of these darker sides, was trying to sort of drive that change internally within Vera Happold, which again, a phenomenal company to work for, but felt that the pace of change and the scale of that change just wasn't going to cut it for what we're trying to achieve in terms of building a more sustainable future. So I met my amazing co-founder who was working for Skanska at the time, and we really bonded over this mutual love-hate relationship, and decided to take a different approach and said, you know, is there another way that we can address this problem? Is there a way that we can help construction be more sustainable within its own workflows in a way that is sensitive to the way that we operate. So not trying to just overhaul everything and disrupt unnecessarily, doing it incrementally and appropriately, but fast and at scale.
Wow. Operationally sensitive way of tracking. I love that concept, that idea because that's something that I harp on all the time of like, if we want to get this data, you have to make it easy for the person that is going to provide that data. So I love that. That's awesome.
It's great to see and hear the way you said it about, you didn't really get to this part to disrupt anything. You just saw this huge problem that you can attack differently, right? Inside of our workflows, but change some of the things. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, how do you even use a tool or do anything to really start to work on your carbon footprint? And let's be honest, one of the reasons, you know, this is a Nathan and I'll get it wrong again, but I'm going to say it. Show me how I'm measured and I'll show you how I act, right? We aren't measured by our carbon footprint in many cases, although that is changing. And it's changing in the UK faster than it is here. It's changing in Europe faster than it is here. But that change is coming here. So how do you work inside of the workflow and still change it, have an impact, but yet stay profitable? Because that's, at the end, we're still being measured that way.
Yeah, sure. So when we started Qflow, we ultimately didn't have a plan on how to fix the problem. And we also didn't have too many assumptions about what that problem looked like. So we went out and we spoke to our colleagues and our colleagues' colleagues and really just tried to understand the industry a bit more. And it was actually talking to Canary Wharf, who are a large general contractor. They're part of Brookfield's group. And they had this really specific pain point around tracking responsibly sourced timber coming onto site. And this wasn't just a sustainability target for them. It was causing them time losses and also financial losses off the back of that. And so they're like, we've got to figure this out. So when we went to speak to them, we went, well, we've got an idea of maybe how we could fix that. If you'll let us, you know, play with this on site and give you a solution, will you use it and give us some feedback? And they did. We worked with an incredible team on the Wood Wharf development. And ultimately, we started by just taking a photograph of the delivery slips as they came on with this timber. And we were instantly digitizing that and auditing it against the project's requirements and telling them, well, you've just had a delivery. It's not certified. You better do something about it. So they were then able to immediately follow up with their subcontractors and say, hey, guys, the wrong materials on site. Please don't install it because that's going to mean rework. That's going to mean delays, extra spend. Just get it off. So it was helping Canary Wharf deliver their sustainability target, but also saving them time and money and headaches, ultimately saving them stress on site. So we were really trying to make sure that as we were addressing the sustainability targets of the industry, we were also doing that in a way that saved them time and money and aligned with that bottom line. And as we scaled that up to tracking not just timber, but tracking concrete and steel and waste, we realized that the value of this data goes so much further than just understanding carbon emissions and embodied carbon. It was helping them understand supply chain and resilience and dependencies, particularly during the war in Ukraine. When that kicked off, that had a massive knock-on effect on timber and metals supply in our part of the country. And so all of a sudden, companies needed to understand, where have we got these redundancies? Where have we got these issues? How do we respond quickly and work with our supply chain to make sure that we're not stuck? And actually that data that helps us be more sustainable is the same data that helps us be more resilient and more cost-effective and more productive as an industry. And I think it's such a small step, but it's one that we've struggled to take so far, is this understanding that being sustainable is not an expensive thing. In many ways, being more sustainable is actually going to make you more cost-effective and more profitable as a company. It's a hard thing to sort of believe up front because we've been told a lot of the time that's not the case. But once people start using the data, they're like, ah, this has saved my finance team 50% of their time. They're so happy. Oh, who knew? And you're like, yeah, I know. It's great, right? You just like, carry on.
Well, it's an amazing piece because it we do look at stuff so singularly, and we get so focused, and we think it's going to cost us. I mean, I'm just thinking, Nathan, of other things I've heard that it's like lean. Oh, I don't want to do lean because it's going to take me forever to relearn everything and put all my processes in. And it's like, well, we got to be careful. We can't waste that time. I'm like, yeah, okay. But you could also save that time by doing that. Like, you're saving your people. It's an interesting approach. And so tell me, like, you're taking photos of packing slips. What other things are you doing at the site? How is this functioning? Like, what does the workflow look like? Because that, I think so many people, again, think a new workflow, new tool, new disruption to my day, not disruption to my world, but disruption to my flow. I like the Q flow part. So talk to me a little bit about how that actually works. And then Nathan can dig into the data going a lot further, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. So the workflow on site, we really tried to prioritize minimizing disruption to the site team. And this was super clear from that very first deployment with Canary Wharf, that if we were introducing a new thing for the project team to do, they were not going to use it. Particularly as we were introducing this halfway through a project with a supply chain that were already stressed out and wound up, it was not going to work. So for the site team using Qflow, all they have to do is take a photograph as the truck comes to the project. And that's it. So very much in the same way that if you've got a banksman who is saying, truck, come this way, lay down your materials over here, they then just hang that piece of paper out the window and snap a photograph of it. And that's it. So tech literacy, if you can take a selfie, you can use Qflow. That's kind of what we're asking the site guys to do. It's about that far. So we then let the AI do the heavy lifting off the back of that. So they snap the photograph, they hit send, they're done. We then use a load of AI to pull the information out of those images, regardless of whether it's handwritten, typed, covered in mud, scrumpled. Don't worry, the AI is actually incredibly capable. We then pull that out, structure it into a database, and audit it against the project's requirements. So for Canary Wharf, it was FSC timber. For many others, it will be CARES certification for steel. It will be ISO certifications for bricks and blocks. It really depends what you're trying to achieve as a project. But we'll tell the site team if something is wrong or missing and they need to take some action. So it's filtering through that data so they don't have to look at every delivery. 99% of those deliveries, they don't even need to think about. It's just the 1% that have a problem with them that they then need to take an action off the back of. And that then prevents them having to take remediative action later on, obviously saving a lot of time and stress on site.
You hit a number of keys. Nathan, I'm going to let you jump in.
Yeah, there's definitely a reason why you invited me to this interview, Jeff. I've written so many points down. Let's start with the first one because you were close, Jeff. Tell me how I measure and I'll tell you how I behave is Eli Goldratt. We'll get it one day. But his book that's over my shoulder, The Goal, is a fantastic book where he brings up this concept of a gatekeeper and the importance of gatekeepers, which is really who are you describing. And so this concept of servicing the gatekeeper is so important to make these digital systems work, and that, you know, you have to meet them where they are, and build tools that really service their needs. But once you get that data, once you get it from it, that digital multiplier that you described, like that is the storyline that I think, you know, every tech startup in this industry has to go through in one way, shape or another. So I love just this story as a whole. I mean, congratulations on really understanding what it takes to build a user experience and build software that serves this industry, that understands the supply and the demand and that it is. Otherwise, it's just garbage in, garbage out, because so many folks want to focus on the latter half of the digital multiplier, assuming you have the data, but you don't, right? Yeah, go for it.
I think one of my favorite things is when a client comes to us and goes, AI, I want AI. And you're like, why? Like, to do what? And it's funny because we're such a problem first company. We're not a tech first company at all. Yeah, we use AI, but that's because it's the right tool to do the job. It's like, you're not going to pick up a saw to hammer a nail. Come on, guys. So I find it fascinating and hilarious when clients come to us and say that. And the first question is like, what are you actually trying to achieve? And the challenge for this industry right now is that we are going to struggle to properly leverage AI because our data is so bad. And exactly to your point, Nathan, if it's rubbish in, rubbish out, trash in, trash out, you're just not going to learn anything. And so we've got to focus on getting good quality, complete data to then leverage the AI. And it's a journey. You can't skip ahead with this one, unfortunately.
Yeah, one and then the other. Well said.
We can't skip ahead, but
you can in some ways.
I was going to give you. Well, we've said this. It's an accelerant, right? AI is an accelerant for a lot of the things that we would have had to do with complicated machine learning and combinations of things, including human intervention along the way. So it is an accelerant, but it's really funny because I read a lot of stuff. Obviously, we do the news here all the time. And every time I hear, I was going to give you credit because you didn't say AI until way in. And all you did was say like, and then our AI does a thing. Bye.
Yeah.
And we keep going because people consistently out there talking, it's like telling me that you have gas in your car consistently before you tell me where you're going or what you did. So I have gas, went to grocery store. I have gas, went skiing. I have gas. I'm like, I don't care. I don't care if you pedaled. I don't care if you use a steam engine. I don't really care. It worked. It's fine. Don't tell me what's in the, you know, don't keep telling me you have gas. And it's so many times I read it and it's just like, oh my gosh, there's gas in the engine. I get it. Okay. You have an engine that runs. Let's go. So I'm interested because, you know, ESG over here in the US is really misunderstood and it's starting to get really, and Nathan can attest to this, it's starting to get really contentious because it's extremely hard, at least in the eyes of our owners, et cetera, to measure true impact across the board. You know, and so I'm wondering, as you're going through this process, like, what are you learning about decarbonization as a whole? What are you learning about how we start to maybe quantify from tip to tail our carbon impact, especially when, you know, it's massive, 40% of raw resources, 40% of waste. Like, that's huge. And I actually know that owners out there are really interested in this. And so are contractors. Contractors are interested because owners are interested.
Yeah.
So how are you seeing this, you know, at least maybe the level, the playing field level? Because there is a lot of misunderstanding about how it all works.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because what we've seen in the UK echoes so perfectly what we're now seeing in the US. So sort of maybe 5 years out in terms of timeline. Exactly as you described, Jeff, the owners are driving it. It's typically commercially driven. It's written into contracts, often driven in because of the funding that they've got or whether they're listed, saying, you know, we need to report on this. That then trickles down to the GC and then they're saying, great, how do I get this data? And that's exactly what we saw in the UK. Sort of around 2019, the government got a little bit more involved in that. And we've seen similar things in the US, although obviously that varies slightly. You've got the federal IRA legislation, which put inside a lot of great incentives. But then you've got the individual state level drivers. So you'll see New York and Massachusetts are pushing much further than other states around decarbonization, particularly also including the scope 3 and the embodied carbon piece, which a lot of states aren't looking at right now. But overwhelmingly, what we see across the industry is it's not the legislation and the regulation that's driving this. It's very much the private clients, the commercial drivers. And that's exactly what we saw in the UK. What we have seen in the UK, and I'm now starting to see in the US, is that, yes, the owners and the clients started it, but the GCs are now starting to champion it because they see it as a way of winning work, of differentiating, of actually being the preferred contractor and the preferred partner for some of the most prestigious projects anyway. So you know it's the big tech companies, it's the big prestigious developers who are really pushing for this. And if the GCs want to win that premium work, they're saying, okay, we're going to find a way to deliver these decarbonization targets, but in a way that doesn't kill my team with reporting. And so a lot of the companies that we're working with in the US are in exactly that position, where they've been asked by clients to deliver, you know, scope 3 carbon reporting, and they're going, you're what? From my supply chain? Are you insane? And suddenly going, right, we need to find a way to do this. And then they come to Qflow and they're like, okay, that's a lot easier than I thought. Fine, we can now do that. And they're able to have much more productive and exciting conversations with their clients on that journey as well. And we sort of support them at every step along that way.
Well, I think you hit on the number one way to get at the heart of the GCs in the US, and that's to give them a strategic advantage, right? That this is a beautiful time that way. And this is why I love construction. I love our GCs out there. I love our trade contractors. It's vehemently, you know, competing with one another. And at the highest level, we have some incredible general contractors that are super forward, and them driving for a competitive advantage through not only now their tools, but their reporting capabilities and their ability to deliver great environmental understanding and drive reduced waste, reduced rework. I mean, just the fact that something doesn't get installed and because it's the wrong thing and it can go back is a huge piece of that. Used to get then ripped out. Once it was put in and ripped out, it's no longer usable. So it is definitely going to the landfill. Again, you're reducing waste there. And, you know, I could see, especially in the US, talking to a lot of our trade contractors, one of the biggest things they need is, like, I don't want to show up to do work if you have only 3/4 of the supply that I need, because that mobilization is far more costly. I'd rather you tell me you have nothing than half of my order. I heard that Trent Leinenbach. Trent, thanks for that nugget at one point. He was like, look, it's either 100% or nothing, because my team's there to completely do the install, to mobilize and get going. And this start and stop crap has to end. And it really is supply chain visibility that does that for you. So not only are you solving GC problems, but and creating a strategic advantage to win work, because man, that bid room, I remember I just came from a 3-year stint in pre-construction. That bid room and chasing work, that's the real deal. That's serious. Everybody's looking for an advantage because everybody's got incredible people. Everybody building incredible buildings or roads or bridges or, you know, new developments. So how are you going to stand out? You're going to stand out not only by the technology and the experience that you're providing, but on the back end, what I saw, Brittany, in the UK that I thought was interesting, Mark Reynolds talked about this years prior to it happening. And I think it's what US owners are looking at, is that very soon, we're not going to look at just the cost of a building as the value of the asset. The value of the asset is going to be its carbon footprint and its viability into the future. And that's actually going to, again, be a competitive advantage for owners that are building those spaces that reach that new target. And it's always the ones who are thinking ahead. So I think you're dead on to something here that's going to help the industry, kind of a snowball effect.
So there's two things I want to pick up on there. First one is that little nugget about, unless there's 100%, I don't want to be there. That's the exact kind of thing that just blows my mind every time we talk to clients when we're sort of showing them the data and we're talking them through this. And this is one of the things I'm loving most about spending time in the US, is that, you know, we've been working with UK clients for like the last 6 years. We've seen pretty much every type of construction, most of the things we've heard before. We then come to the US and we show them this data and they're like, that would really help with the missing hardware, the missing doorknobs. And you're like, sorry, what? Like, what do you mean? And they go down this like daisy chain of, well, we got to the end of the project and we found out that we were 200 short. And so we couldn't hand over. So we were 2 weeks late on handover because we just didn't have enough doorknobs on site. I was like, really did not think that that was going to be an issue, but amazing that the data can flag that to you. And it's just hearing how people are going to get and do get these little nuggets of value from the data that, you know, they never knew they needed before until they went, oh, I can see that now. Great, let's go. So it's just like really adding, stacking on top that, you know, yeah, this data is important for decarbonization, but it's going to help you find the doorknobs. Woo, great. So yeah, that's one of the things I love about like spending all this time with our clients. I find it both hilarious and also fascinating. But coming back to that point from Mark Reynolds, this really ties into the sort of long-term sort of blue skies mission of Qflow, is to sort of unlock the circular economy in construction, to say, you know, we don't need to keep building from those raw resources that we're extracting at, you know, untold cost to our planet and our people, but actually we can build from the materials we've already got to hand. The blocker to that is we don't know what materials we've got to hand. And if you go to any owner and say, how many doors have you got in this building? They're going to go, I don't know, let alone know what standard those doors meant or how old they are. So actually building up this detailed picture of everything that goes into a building is so critical for the owners to be able to value that building in the future. Yes, from a carbon perspective, so how much carbon is embodied in there, but also what's the net present value of those materials that I've just installed for when I decommission it in 30, 40, 50 years time, and I want to then sell them back on. I either want to reintroduce them to the supply chain or I want to repurpose them in another asset. So instead of 40% of my project's bill being on materials, I might only need to spend 10% of my project bill on materials because I've managed to reclaim such a large portion. So I really think the future of our industry, you know, it's not going to be necessarily AR, VR. It might be, I don't know. But I definitely think from a really hard physical piece, it's going to be circular.
I would love it to be that, but I fully agree with you. We've been sitting here on a show for 10 years now talking about AR and MR, and we're kind of looping back to maybe we were a little bit too futuristic, a little too out there, huh, Nathan? I'm sure there's a few things in there you want to dig into.
I wasn't the one saying that, yeah. But I have been a data guy. But to your point, so ironically, Jeff and I will be in Austin, Texas. I don't know if you'll be around in April, but we have a topic for the AEC Integration Summit that follows on from a workshop that Jeff and I did with the Construction Users Roundtable and Owners Group around ESG programs and how do we get them deployed at the project level. So we titled it Keeping Up with Project Health Metrics. And it's around this whole concept of the triple bottom line of, if you know, how do you balance the financial component, the environmental component, and then just the individual wellness, which really everything you're doing about servicing the gatekeeper and making it easy for folks is part of that, you know, fighting burnout and fighting a lot of the mental health challenges within the industry. If there's any way that we can either in our virtual roundtable as we prepare for this, or, you know, incorporate your learnings and what we're trying to do to solve this very big problem, kudos to what you've done. And we'll definitely get you introduced to Justin Seymour with Avocado, who's going to be the team lead. Jackson Hoggard, if he's been on the podcast before, is awesome. He's super passionate about this stuff, as well as Jim Ellis from Kurt, that we'll introduce you to those guys.
Absolutely. Yeah, would love to help on that. And just, I mean, something that triggered a memory for me was talking about the AR, VR piece. I remember when we founded Qflow and we were talking to investors to say, you know what, we've never done this before, but we know the industry and we think we could do something cool. They went, what, paper? The industry doesn't run on paper. And I'm like, have you been to a construction site? And they're like, yeah, but surely it will be all digital. Like in the next 3 years, you guys will be irrelevant because everything will be digital. Everything will integrate perfectly. All the data will feed seamlessly up to the owner. Like you guys aren't going to be needed. And I was like, okay, yeah, sure. You hold on to that belief and I will go speak to someone else who like actually knows what construction is. 6 years down the line, 95% of documents we capture are still paper-based. So yeah, paper. We can ingest digital information. We love it when it's digital because it's so much cleaner and easier to process, but 95% is still paper. Come on, guys.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny because you're absolutely right. First of all, I'd love to have been in that room and be like, oh, great. Yeah. So you don't get it.
No.
You live in an ivory tower and have never been to a job site and don't understand the amount of paper. Yeah. And secondly, what you're not understanding is we're set to take digital. I could have guaranteed you, Brittany, without even asking, if I drove up with a digital form for you, you could probably just ingest it and it's still that data is flowing to a new place, but you have a whole new set of tools, a whole new thing it's comparing it against, and an analysis to provide a different outcome. I don't care how it starts, but you have to start at ground zero, which ground zero is still paper. And quite frankly, in some cases, paper just still works as long as we can take it digital. Yeah. As long as we can do that at the moment, we need it.
Absolutely agree. And, you know, paper, I think, will still play a really important role in our industry down the line. My partner's a landscape architect. He's just gone on a site visit today. He took a big cardboard box full of printed out site maps. And I was like, what are you doing? And he's like, but it's actually the easiest way of seeing everything and comparing them. And I was like, okay, fair play. I'm not going to be a tech dick about this. Like, you carry on with your paper. But I mean, even when we receive digital information, the digital information is a PDF that is emailed. So you still have to do the data extraction piece. So this idea that we're moving to digital systems is still a bit of a falsehood from the industry. We're not moving to, you know, data lakes and, you know, perfectly integrated API accessible systems just yet. We will get there. I fully believe we will get there, but there are steps in between. And, you know, we're not going to get there overnight. We need to take this very, very long tail of a supply chain on that journey with us. And you can't expect a mom and pop shop selling, you know, timber bits for the last minute pickups for trades to suddenly move to a fully integrated digital system. They are still going to be using the carbon copies that we see today. So you've got to be able to capture those tiny little suppliers and the Goliath suppliers like Holcim, who are delivering concrete with digital systems, which is great. Yes, well done, Holcim. But, you know, there's everyone else you've got to deal with as well. So you've got to have that acceptance of multiple different data types.
Yeah, Nathan, I'm having this vision of somebody driving around to pick up those final little bits that you need, because they're everywhere. We have one here in town called Wyalaco, and, you know, you got to go in and see what they've got, and going, oh, well, you've got what I need, but you don't have it digital. Well, I'm going to drive on to the next place. Wait till I submit those hours for how many places I drove around to find that. You're right. We need the bits. Brittany, I'm so glad to hear you say it, but all we've been doing for a very long time is creating digital paper, which actually, to respect our field people, is a lot harder to find because it's not under the seat of the truck or in the trailer. And interesting point, like to your point, Brittany, one of the fastest growing and still biggest vendors in our world of technology is Plans for Less. They create and rock, you know, it's a repographic company. They send out printed plans.
No way.
They do it super cheap. Yeah. And it's growing fast. And I mean, I've known Brian for a really long time and they're doing really well. Paper still has a place, right? It's not, again, meet them where they are. We need digital copies of those things. We do need to be careful. We do want things updated. That's why things like PlanGrid and others, you know, are super powerful, and Revisto and others like that. But in the end, like you said, we got to get stuff built. And can I know that every contractor everywhere has every damn tool or knows how to use it? And then, no. So I fully agree with you, meeting them where they are, and then turning that paper into information. It's unlocking so many other things. But I want to hit one more thing with you that I think is really powerful is you talked about the experience of a circular economy, the experience of the future. You're young, you're diving into this industry. We need more people like you. And this is giving them an opportunity. What we know about our future generations that has been very different from past is they care far less about money and far more about impact and their footprint on the world ahead of them, thanks to what we and other generations before us have done. So how can this kind of play a role in that? I just want to get your perspective on that moving forward, on how this circular economy, this reducing our carbon footprint, making this a more inviting environment for our future could be.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that gets talked about a lot across the industry, across multiple countries, is the skills shortage and being able to attract good skilled people into our industry. And we obviously talk a lot about inclusion and diversity as well, and being able to get more women and minority groups into this industry so that we can actually build for everyone. And one thing that I've definitely noticed is that there are so many more women in sustainability. And actually, we're releasing at the moment a sort of series on women decarbonizing construction, because I keep meeting these amazing startups that are decarbonizing construction and they're all led by women. And I'm like, what? this is amazing. This is great. So I think we're going to continue to see that. We're going to see these passionate, committed, very smart people moving into our industry and believing that they can be better. And it is going to be the sustainability and the circularity piece that is driving that. I also think it's a real, wake up moment for some of the bigger companies that are maybe struggling to attract the right kind of people or struggling to retain great talent, is that they need to think about what is it that's keeping them. That younger generation are staying for the why. Why am I here? What is my impact on the world? How do I feel good about myself in delivering this? And whether you think that's narcissistic or not is, you know, a whole other philosophical debate. But the point being is that if you can help people feel connected to what they do and that they feel that they're doing something good for the planet, which is what they care about, then you're more likely to attract and retain the best people. So being more sustainable, having that drive and that ethos within your company is not just going to help you win work, which is a good thing, but it's also going to help you win great people as well.
I think you're winning. I'm going to say we just dropped the mic right there, because that was awesome, Brittany. That is, you really did a wonderful job of articulating just what's possible for our industry in the future, what's possible from our next generation, our possibilities to diversify the group of people that work here, that win here. And I'm going to throw a stat at you just so people can think about this, that, you know, we have how many women-led companies in our industry right now that are working on sustainability, and only fewer than 30 women founders have ever taken a company public. And that's compared to 6,000 companies now listed on NYSE and the NASDAQ, down from 8,000. So think about that percentage. So think about the opportunity in our world that is being created by fantastically smart, passionate people like you that are awesome. You know, this is a great sustainable place for people to be in the future. And I just want to thank you for sitting down, taking the time to take a risk and meet with me and get on the show with Nathan and I.
No, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, tell people where they can go learn more about Qflow.
So you'll find us on the World Wide Web by searching QualisFlow. I'm sure there'll be a link with this podcast. You can obviously find me on LinkedIn. I'm constantly posting and absolutely love connecting with people there and having interesting debates about the future of construction, the built environment, biodiversity, net gain, circular economy, you name it, I'll talk about it. And obviously do reach out to the team if you want to understand a bit more about what we're doing both in the US, the UK and Australia, and how we might be able to help you on that decarbonization journey.
Well said. Nathan, awesome. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Oh man, that was so much fun. I wish we could go longer.
I know. This is one of those ones where we'll be doing a part
two. Too many notes.
Part two somewhere down the road. But don't worry, Brittany's going to stay with us because I'm really interested to get her take on some of our news. So we're going to get into the construction technology news of the week. Nathan, take it away. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built.
All right, my first one here, Brittany, I picked a couple of US kind of code and other things to get your outsider's opinion on. So this first one here is Virginia pioneers adoption of offsite construction code. This one comes from Construction Dive. So Commonwealth of Virginia last month became the first state to adopt the International Code Council and Modular Building Institute's 1200 and 1205 standard. So essentially this is an early stage because, again, I've been doing some work here locally with Framecad, who is based out of New Zealand, Australia. They have a ton of offsite and prefab standards out there. I was looking for stuff here locally where there are any organizations or different things. There are some sort of offshoots, but it's exciting here to see that Virginia is one of the first ones pioneering. There's been some other cities, I guess, like Salt Lake City and others that have also pioneered adoption of the standard. But as we've talked a lot about on this podcast, and usually look to the UK as you know, the place that where standards come from, as a way of, you know, helping to adopt, you know, hopefully this is going to, you know, help push things along, as well as going to grow adoption, and then really make, I think, inspections, because I think offsite inspections were always the trickiest part of doing this. So I don't know if even like, how does offsite factor into overall, you know, carbon capture and kind of your side of the world too? Just, yeah, any of your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, offsite has been harbored as, you know, something that's going to help us all be more efficient and more sustainable. And I think there is a huge potential in it, but the execution hasn't been great. And part of that, I think, is because there's been a lack of codes and standards to help people understand, you know, what it's going to deliver, how best to execute on it. And we find the same with sustainability. You know, at New York Build a couple of weeks ago, one of the things that kept coming up on the panels was, we don't know what standard we're working to. We don't know what format or framework we need to be delivering this against. And it creates confusion, and it means that people are like, well, I'm not going to engage until I know exactly what I'm doing. There is definitely a tendency in our industry to let perfection get in the way of progress. And that's probably because we're quite risk averse. So, you know, having a clear code, a clear set of standards for offsite, I'm sure will really help people take that leap to adopt it further. And we certainly do see that in terms of reducing waste, improving efficiency on site in particular, it's a really important step, this sort of modern methods of construction and offsite prefab.
Well said.
That's really well said. You're hitting on a couple of things. You answered it the way I was going to answer it. So I'm going to go a little bit opposite here and say, I love the clear codes. I love the framework. This is where I love how we're built as a country with 50 different states to go through this to create a proving ground, right? This is a proving ground for what works and what doesn't before we take this as some national standard. Too many people try to jump to a national standard before it's really gone through the what works and what doesn't work, because things are going to work and things aren't going to work. Failure is pretty much the only option, but iteration is how we solve that. So it's great to see Virginia doing this. I know Utah's working on it. I know a number of states that are working on adopting the codes, working through them. And I'm with you, Brittany. There's far too many people that use the lack of codes, the lack of a framework, to stay sitting on the bench and not involved and not helping the movement, which is actually the boat anchor holding us down. So Nathan, I thought this was a great one. You know, go check it out, take a read, and hopefully if you're big in one of these other states that doesn't have it, let's start getting them there. Let's find the right thing, and then let's take it national, because we have a labor issue, we have waste issue, and look, it's a lot safer to build as much as we can offsite and in our factories. From an experience perspective itself. So, and it'll be great, because someday, Brittany, it'll be a sheet with a whole lot more that Qflow is ingesting and telling you what's making it there. None of this changes. It just evolves. That's what I like. Nathan, absolutely. What else you got, buddy?
So this one comes from Hayes Johnson, shared this on our contact forum Slack channel. So thank you, Hayes, from Drone DJ. So I was not aware that there are efforts around in the drone world. For those of you that know, DJI is like the king of all drones, and is, you know, kind of has a huge market share here in the U.S. But again, because they are a Chinese company, there are, you know, fears around use of, again, different GPS and different other bands. It kind of almost looks very similar to, I think, some like the TikTok ban. Sort of, not to get, you know, too political into things, but it could have, again, huge impacts on our industry if there is all of a sudden a ban on DJI drones and we have now no communications with them. A lot of folks that do a lot of business using DJI drones could be impacted. So one to kind of keep our eyes on and see where it goes. We need to get into the politics of it. Obviously, Brittany, you don't need to mess with our stuff unless you've got other equivalent, you know, I mean, crazies trying to ban TikTok out in the UK, do you?
Well, there's been a bit of an interesting scandal around Huawei And whether they can have the 5G contract in the UK. So we have similar sort of security questions. And obviously there's been the nuclear power plants being developed and the Chinese have a large stake in that and whether they're allowed to. And yeah, it's a big, you know, can of worms to open. But I think just generally our industry is having to try and figure out the whole data security piece and how we handle that and how far to take it. We've seen like two ends of the scale from our clients. We've seen the people who are so locked down that you can't breathe for fear of breaching like an NDA or a data security piece. And it's just very hard to work with, to the point that there comes points where we go, we cannot service you because you are so tight on the way that data can be used. We can't even process your data. So yeah, sorry, we can't sign the contract. And then we've got the opposite end of our clients who are like, yeah, sure, whatever, signing everything without even looking at it. And you're like, you do realize there's data involved here and you should have an opinion on that or at least be aware of it. So I'm not saying either of those is good, somewhere in the middle, preferably. But it's an important thing for our industry to really start thinking about and getting a bit more of an awareness of around digital systems and data and what that means, both in a positive way, but also a positive, like a possible negative way as well.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm going to go, Nathan, you picked a great time to put this on too, because it is an election year.
Right.
So we never know.
We're recording on Super Tuesday.
Yeah, we are recording on Super Tuesday. I'm not jumping in on either side because we know where that goes. But I'm just going to say, you never know what's going to happen in election year. You never know how it's going to push. I'm with you, though. You know, it's an interesting problem given drones is one of the few technologies that we've talked consistently about over time that has really reached a pretty good saturation rate in the industry. So this would be a heck of a blow to cutting that down. Yeah, it might give another manufacturer an opportunity to grow, but you can't grow that fast and supply what we need. So it would be catastrophic to see that go. There's got to be, you know, other ways to confirm and control that those DJI drones aren't sending information anywhere they shouldn't. And that leads to, where would I go with this, Nathan? But modern technology, modern IT teams that understand ingress and egress and can monitor everything. Well, there's an opportunity. And Brittany, that's a whole second episode about the I'm too secure. I had a call with somebody not too long ago. It's like, oh, we're looking for this. And I came up with all the ideas and was telling them about all the different groups I know. And they were like, oh yeah, by the way, we need a private version of it. And I'm like, that's not how it works. We should have started with that. Because my answer would have been, Excel's your friend. See you later. I'm done. So there has to be a balance, right? I say this to people all the time. I've been saying it for years. Microsoft, Amazon, Google, they get attacked all day, every day. Your data center, your private cloud will never be as strong as theirs. It is about how you deploy it. It is about how you utilize their tools to secure things, for sure. However, right, you're never going to reach that. So get over it and let's start to figure out how we can make this data work for us. So,
well said. What do you got, Jeff?
Well, here we go. I'm going to pivot. And actually, Nathan, you talked about this and I was thinking about, Jackson Hoggart when I grabbed this article. So this is Depth Builder, which is my good friend, Jesse Jesus Hernandez, that was actually on the episode that's airing today while we're recording this. And invest in who you got. It's not just about production. He takes a really interesting approach to talking about leadership and moving from the issues that we have today and the labor shortages we have to solving those problems. He said the labor shortage was obvious 30 years ago when he got into the trades, and he's seen wages triple, CTE programs emerge, nonprofits developed, fancy marketing campaigns, but we're still having the same problems. And we're still not unlocking the future of changing how we work and changing how our craft workers engage and are engaged. And I think this is a huge opportunity. When you think, why did I think of Jackson Hoggart? Because when Jackson took over the family business, one of the first things he did was say, I'm going to dig into the shop floor. I'm going to find out where our problems are. I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to get involved. And he did. And he consistently improved the lives of the people, the crafts workers that were working with him and for him, and to the point where it ended up being profitable. It ended up being an entire department. It ended up becoming part of the fabric of his company. And that's what Jesse Hernandez is teaching. That's what he's out there, you know, looking for those leaders, looking for those people that have realized they have a problem and that they can change it. But I'm going to tell you, there's no fancy AI bullet. There's nothing easy about this. It's sweat equity. It takes time. It takes investment. It takes dedication. And most importantly, in my opinion, and this is what I think Jackson has in spades, is it takes courage. It takes courage as a leader to lean in, get uncomfortable, and try to learn and roll up your sleeves. So I'm interested, Nathan, in you know, you've met Jesse over the years, you know him. And I'm interested in your take on this article.
Well, and Jesse's a big lean guy. I mean, I can almost read between the lines of like the history of Toyota and the culture that they built and this concept of Gemba walks, of, you know, walking in the shoes of each of these individuals and really empathizing with them. And again, Brittany, everything you've been preaching as to how you collect good data in the first place. So I think it's awesome that you picked this article. I think it's, you know, the lean world that had traditionally been, you know, more anti-tech and has become more open to it now. And the BIM world that's kind of, you know, opposite sides are all realizing that, hey, we're all actually speaking the same language here. It's just different sides of it.
Yeah, it's super true. And I think just talking about teams, and obviously as a small company, I mean, we're 50 people now, so we've sort of doubled over the last year. So that's introduced some interesting dynamics within the team that have been really positive, but also really challenging. And like thinking about building leadership, how much you're hiring in that leadership or nurturing it internally. One thing that I've really learned over the last couple of years is that for individuals to be successful, you actually need to make the team successful, because so much of personal happiness and feeling of sort of acceptance and feeling connected to the space actually comes from the team around them. So we've done DISC assessments. I don't know if you've come across them, but there's this amazing book called Surrounded by Idiots, which is just my Bible on this. I love it. And it means that you can very quickly understand someone's approach to the world. So it's not a, like, it's not categorizing people, but it's really about understanding how they will respond to certain situations. And we found this invaluable as a team. We started with doing it just as the senior team to understand, you know, if someone's a bit more green blue or a bit more red yellow. I'm very red yellow, so you can sort of look up what that means. But what I've learned is that for me to get the best out of my team, I have to change the way I communicate to them, to really tone down some of the redness and help encourage some of their greenness in the right way. And that has not only helped me feel more connected to the team, but also helped them feel more connected to everyone else around them. So I think there is individual work to do in this, but you can never achieve leadership in isolation. That would be complete madness. Leadership has to be done within the environment of a team. And I think sometimes you see people going on these really expensive leadership courses and just learning how to fix themselves. Actually, it's not about that. It's about understanding everyone around you and thinking about how you work with them.
That is so well said. That's exactly right, Brittany, because and my favorite is, well, I just need my team to be better. And I'm like, yeah, no, actually, the person who needs the most work is you.
Yeah.
And if you're out there listening going, I don't need any work, then you really need to go to depthbuilder.com and find out more about being transparent and understanding and seeing yourself for what it is. Because we are all usually the problem in some way, shape, or form. There's nothing wrong with what Brittany said about, I need to learn that I'm, you know, I am this person and I go this way is where I lean my tendencies. That's fine. Because if you can acknowledge that, then you can deliver a message differently, get more out of the team, and vice versa. If they know about that about you, they can deliver their communication to you a little better. We can gel as a team and everybody wins. But nobody gets out without doing the work, kind of like technology too.
Everybody's to make it super tangible for the listeners, a really easy example of this is if someone sends me an email, which is a long paragraph of text, I will not read it. I have told my team, like, if you want to send me comms, amazing, but it has to be in bullet point format. And like, at best, like, it, the absolute best scenario is have a too long didn't read at the top. Otherwise, it's just going to go to the, like, onto the to-do list and never really get touched. In the same way, as if I email my co-founder, Jade, if I just send her bullet points, she will email me back being, can I have the details, please? So I've learned to do the opposite for her and put in all the detail in the email, send her links to things, attach documents, give her as much information up front so that she doesn't have to come back to me, because she won't make a decision unless she's got all the detail. So we are complete opposites on that front. And two small changes from our end on the way that we communicate with each other has accelerated our output dramatically and meant that we make better decisions much quicker. And that was literally just changing the way we email each other.
Especially growing to the size you are, you're at the most vulnerable stage for startups. So it's great to hear you guys focusing on that growth. All right, here's my last one, and I'm really excited about this one. This is TED Magazine Digital. Winning with technology. Investments in tech are helping distributors better align with their customers' operations. But where should distributors focus their investment dollars? So really talking about wrapping around, I thought this would be really good given Brittany's view and us talking about supply chain and talking about decarbonization. Plus, these are two wonderful people. This is Denise Devine and Josh Bone being interviewed, talking about, Denise was with Steel Toad Consulting at the time, dedicated to helping construction companies integrate and implement modern construction workflows and technology. And Josh is the executive director of Electri International. So they're really focusing this on the electrical industry. And just about what the change in the marketplace looks like and how distributors can play a role in understanding supply chain and helping their contractors. Because just like what Brittany's doing with QFlow and analyzing it when it gets there, wouldn't it be great if we had our distributors getting to the source of the problems ahead of time, or doing more of what I think is a great idea here, is that they can play a role in being an expert to offer alternative solutions around products that are more viable, more carbon efficient, easier, and doing more for offsite construction. So this was some of the things. It was cool to hear, Denise talk about the technology side and talking about the integration and looking at supply chain, and Josh talking about the labor side and how distributors can do more. It's really funny, but we talk about this big offsite construction and we think it's this major swing. We've actually been going through it for years. We used to get bolts and things in different pieces and piles, and now they're kits that show up that are already fabricated and have everything and they need to go on. And this is really about how can distributors and suppliers in the end provide more solutions that reduce our need for labor on site and make our labor on site more efficient. You can dig through this. It's a great back and forth between the two of them. And, it's about the electrification too. There's something that I think electrical contractors need to understand, and I think the industry needs to understand as well, is that so much more is electrified these days, that the amount of scope of work that's being placed on our electricians moving forward is going to grow exponentially. Low voltage being as big as it is, and the fact that it's going to start to, because from an efficiency perspective, running most of the things in a hotel room off of power over Ethernet is the future of how things are going to operate. Lights are going to run that way. Your hair dryer is going to run that way. And all of those things in a hotel room that are standard are going to be running off of, that low, what was normally considered low voltage. That's all part of that contractor scope now for the electrification, not to mention the fact that we have an electrified vehicle fleet that's hitting the United States that has all of those needs. It's just growing ridiculously. So suppliers need to play a huge role in connecting that. And I think they can. One other little trick to my suppliers out there: you've already gone through your industrial revolution. if you think back to your factories and how you used to build and how you used to produce the widgets that you produce them far different today. You're more profitable, more efficient. Our contractors are about to go through that same transformation. Who better than to sit alongside them and educate them and help them and be there for those problems than someone who's already been through it? Yes, our industries are different, but there's a lot that's the same and there's a lot we can learn from one another. So I had a lot of fun reading this article. I hope everybody gets out there and reads it. Nathan, I'm interested because you know you spend a lot of time with both Denise and Josh and this had to hit home.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, specifically the question around, you know, what do contractors want from distributors and the conversations that we've been having on our virtual roundtables with the group from National Electrical Manufacturers Association, NEMA, and their group that they formed around ideas for industry and their harmonized data model that is essentially taking the fact that the Amazons and the Home Depots of the world and their transparency of availability and pricing. And again, that the whole way that works that, you know, frankly, purchasers in the commercial world want that same sort of touch and feel and the ability to manipulate things and make those choices. And so the Grangers and the others of the world are having to keep up with that. And so I think it's pushing things in the right direction. It's really cool to see, even though, yeah, it may create some pain points for some of those that have those legacy systems. But ultimately, yeah, the consumer wins in the end.
Brittany, I'm wondering what you think about this one.
Yeah, so I don't know so much about the distribution side of things, but one thing that we're definitely seeing suppliers be asked for is EPDs or environmental product declarations. And if distributors can be part of the journey to collate those from suppliers and make them available to the general contractors and the architects doing specification, that would be a huge win, particularly in the electrical side of things and around MEP. The sort of supply of EPDs for some of these complex composite items is just non-existent. And it's a real pain point that we keep getting thrown at us saying, well, we need these EPDs because it gives us the carbon factor associated with these materials so that we can do these calculations. At the moment, we can't even start to quantify the embodied carbon of some of our MEP items because we don't know what they are. So a real win for suppliers is going to be producing those EPDs. And there's some great startups that are coming up at the moment to help them do that. And if you're not sure about those, then we've done an article on that at Qflow as well. But also to then for the distributors to be able to then consolidate those EPDs from the manufacturers and make them available is going to be a really important win and could be a massive differentiator. There are now thresholds being asked by clients to say that 20%, 50%, 80% of materials procured must have an EPD. And at the moment, the industry average is about 20% of materials have EPDs. So there's a huge amount of legwork that needs to be done across the industry and across the supply chain to start producing these documents, but then also make them accessible and make them valuable.
Well, that was a nice opportunity for people listening to keep taking this further. And Nathan, I'm gonna go with you there. That's episode 3. So Brittany, we got
actually,
two more
that one's episode 4.
Episodes.
That's the digital multiplier on the other side. Episode 3 was the whole human and communication side. We got to dig into DISC and Myers-Briggs and all that language and try and come up with some standards there. So yeah, hopefully you got some time, Brittany.
Always. Gotta push this.
I'm just going to say, if you're listening in and you have a spot for Brittany on a panel somewhere or on the stage somewhere, let's just do it because I think this would be awesome. Brittany, I can't thank you enough. This has been an awesome episode. Thanks for sitting down with Nathan and I.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to meeting in person at some point.
Well, you let us know when you're over here. Nathan, it's been great to see you. Thanks for sitting down today. And I told you this was a good one.
Oh, man. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Brittany Harris. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.